Welcome to this week's edition of the Aquila Report and Weekly Review. It's always our delight to come before you and have these articles that are the top 10, which the readers of the Aquila Report chose from the reading the Aquila Report itself. And it's interesting, Paul, as you and I were talking offline before we came online, that I mentioned that there's a sort of a thread. We always say that, but in this case, I think almost all 10 articles that we'll be dealing with out of the 56 that were could have been chosen just seems to have an interesting thread. So this is Dominic Aquila and Paul Harrell in this podcast of the Aquila Report. So, Paul, I think we're going to find this enlightening for us today.
Absolutely.
And helpful. And I think tomorrow when the newsletter comes out, all these articles will be hyperlinked and ready to be clicked on. And as we always say, feel free to forward the email to friends and family members. Feel free to have discussions, maybe your small groups or friends that you talk with online or long distance and or even short distance. And I think it's something the real world in which we're living. I think these articles really address those kinds of situations.
I agree. And, you know, I also over the weekend had a sermon sent to me from the Gospel Reformation Network conference, Ian Hamilton. I guess this was last year, so in 2022. And, you know, you always talk about, Dominic, how church history ebbs and flows. And that this was certainly an example of that. And his main point was, you can't judge a denomination based on its confessional standards. You have to judge a denomination based on their willingness to discipline those who don't adhere to those confessional standards. And he gives an entire history of the Church of Scotland. It was fantastic. And it was session 7 of last year of the Gospel Reformation Network. Really, really good stuff. But I think that kind of goes a little bit into this thread that you're talking about that we'll see here in these articles.
Right. Okay. Well, Paul, let's do it like we normally do. You read the top 10 from 10 to 6. I'll read 5 to 1, and then we'll start out.
Number 10 from last week, we have Michael G. Brown. How will Christianity survive during the dark times? That's kind of the thread of this whole thing.
It is.
the number 10 article. All right, number 9, Jeffrey Walton, A Chasm Widens, Traditional Anglicans Plot Faithful Future. Number 8, Brett McCracken, In Praise of the Boring, Uncool Church. Number 7, we have Understanding Ex-Christian America, this by Brad Vermeulen. And then we have number 6 last week, Brenda Haffera, Our Lost Boys.
Okay, then picking up at number 5, Agatha Christie Revisions are the Writing on the Wall by Bruce Pardy. And then number 4 is Don't Leave Well Enough Alone, Why I Am Preaching at Satan Con. And that was number 4. Number 3, The Lord's Day Minimum Daily Requirement, Beggars Should Be Choosers, Part 3 by Jack Miller. Number 3 is America's Imperial Ideology by R.R. Reno. Number 2, scroll to the title, Are There Trustworthy Protestant Universities? The Battle for Christian Heritage Education Rages. And that is by Scotty Yenner. And then number 1 is Are There Trustworthy Protestant... Wait a minute, that's number 1. I'm sorry, I skipped over number 2. No, I didn't. I did right. I'm sorry. I counted wrong, but we'll keep on going. Here we go. So we are talking about this article by Scotty Yenner, Are There Trustworthy Protestant Universities? Interesting take that this Scotty Yenner gives to us. The decline of Protestant higher education is manifest. At the time of their founding, most Protestant colleges, universities had a strong sense of mission connected to preparing Christians for ministry, missions, and trades. But something has changed. He says it's James Turnstead Burkittel, documents in his meticulous Dying of Light, the disengagement of colleges and universities from their Christian churches, school after school, in tradition after tradition, chose American respectability over fidelity to a distantly Christian, a distinctly Christian mission. This tomb, T-O-M-E, and I wonder if there was sort of like a the sound in thing that T-O-M-B, this is the tome, relates, details how Congregationalists lost Dartmouth and Beloit, how Presbyterians lost Lafayette and Davidson, how Baptists lost Wake Forest and Linfield, how Lutherans lost Gettysburg, St. Olaf, and Concordia, how Catholics lost Boston College and St. Mary's College of California, and how Evangelicals lost Azusa Pacific. So there you just set, it sets out the predicate with that, that institutions that start off with this strong sense of mission, of how it was going to educate in the context of its present day culture at the time it was started, somehow in over time that mission seems to have been lost. So he says, what emerges is a science of higher education apostasy. Schools worry about being perceived as sectarian. That is, of course, related to a particular ideology or church or theology, as it is defined at different times. University programs multiply, necessitating department hiring. Faculty become beholden to professional standards over school missions. The administration wants prestigious faculty and progressively sheds faithful and piety from job description, faithfulness and piety. Faculty statements of faith devolve from active membership in sponsoring church or denomination to nominal membership to acceptance of the college's own faith statement to silent toleration of ill-specific purposes of the institution. Chapels, vestiges of old missions become the only sectarian event on campus, and then they fade, becoming optional or inclusively non-sectarian. Once controversies swirl about chapel, their light is already dying out. So that sets quite a scene for what's going on with Christian colleges, especially as they were related to denominations over the years. And then he refers in this arc to a number of books and or articles that have been written communicate this. He refers to George Marsden, the soul of the American university, to James Keating's Who Killed the Catholic University. A list of apostate universities is much longer than any list of holdouts. David Godwin, president of the K through 12 Association of Classical Christian Schools, which now boasts more than 500 schools, tells me that the number one question he hears is, Where should I send my graduate to college when they finish up high school? Are there universities that Christian parents can still trust? He has some interesting charts here of those universities. Just he takes representative universities that were aligned with denominations, like Southern Methodist University, for instance. When it talks about what is its present status. Faculty faith, no requirement. Then it also mentions the growth of DEI, diversity, equity, and inclusion. The question is, are this DEI offices opened on campus, and how significant, what role do they play? And the answer there was yes. And also then, is there any emphases or chapters of the LGBTQ students on the campus? And so at Southern Methodist, which obviously with the name was related to the United Methodist Church, so there are no faculty requirements. The DEI office is there and operating, and the LGBTQ center is functioning. Calvin University, which is affiliated with the Christian Reformed Church, faculty require church membership, a firm creedal statement of faith, and DEI character tests, whatever that is. Then they do have a DEI presence there, LGBTQ, yes. So, and then you have Baylor, you have Wheaton College, you have Grand Canyon University, all, you know, universities that, or colleges aligned with aligned with Christian universities in that concept. There are those then, he says, are teetering, like Samford University. The faculty have a creedal affirmation of faith and engage with Jesus. There's a DEI office, and while there may be LGBTQ students, there's a club, but it's not recognized by the administration. Biola also has a creedal statement, DEI office, and no, they do not have LGBTQ and so forth. Okay. And then holdout universities, another chart, and their list, Liberty University, Karen, Cedarville, Colorado Christian University, all of these basically do require faculty to have strong faith statement that they have to affirm. There are, except for one, which is Liberty University, there is no DEI office, and none of these have LGBTQ clubs or any kind of recognition. So the point that he makes in this article is that the desire for professional acceptance, for being seen as not just sectarian, but, you know, being able to navigate through this world, have created that movement, the movement in the church. He ends up, schools that aim for prestige and excellence, as the current American regime defines it, and are most likely to accommodate our cultural presuppositions. Fewer prestige schools embrace a conservative Protestant social teaching that emphasizes marriage, recommends different roles for men and women, and shuns same-sex marriage. Students interested in becoming doctors or lawyers might choose Baylor, SMU, or Wheaton. On the other hand, schools without signs of American decadence are less descript, and their chief virtue being that they fail to promote any kind of vice. So, this is an interesting article. Gives a big sort of the big picture of where colleges are. Just one more comment that's not really here. As I teach, when I teach American church history, one of the parts that I cover, one of the areas, is the development of the Christian schools as the United States, as in its colonial days, was developing, of course, with the first formally organized college, which was Harvard in Boston, Cambridge area. And that was in 1636. By 1692, right around there, it had already gone through the same kinds of changes that this article expresses. And then someone over time, before this article here, said, you know, what is the length of time where the average institution that has an evangelical beginning before it goes, changes itself so it doesn't look like what its original mission was? And the average time is 70 years. So you have that sort of list. Obviously, if that's average, you have some that are less and some that are longer. And it's interesting. So it isn't just our time now. It's been true since going back to Harvard in the 1600s that this has been around. So, Paul, it's nothing really new if you put it in a broader historical context, but it's the time we're living in, and we're seeing it happen right before us.
Well, and this may be one of the most practical or useful articles that's ever been on the Aquila Report, honestly, because there are so many parents, and I have sisters that are getting ready to send, their kids, nieces and nephews off to college, and they wonder the same thing. You know, I mean, where can we send them where it's not going to just be essentially this woke religion, you know, foisted on them from every possible angle? And I don't know of anybody that's ever broken it out like this. I mean, the graphs, quite frankly, or the charts, where they're just highlighting, you know, regime-aligned Christian universities. So these are the ones that have essentially sold out. And then the teetering universities, those who are close to selling out, and then those who are, holding firm. I just feel like this is a very useful article, and no doubt it's number one, considering we've got commencement happening all across the country where this new crop of college freshmen are graduating high school.
Exactly. So we commend that to you. So you'll get that tomorrow in your inbox and can read it in more detail, and also some of the out quotes and the articles and books that are referenced there. Well, number two takes us in the same general area, but now more into the America's Imperial Ideology by R.R. Reno. And it's dealing more with how our government has done things. What is perceived to be the religious bonding that America has, because it's a unique kind of bonding. So while it isn't Christian in the sense that they all articulate that all churches articulate a confession of faith as much as the Christian ethos was very much present in the world. And so anyway, here's how Reno starts his article. On March 20, the United States organized a meeting of the United Nations Security Council on the following topic: integrating the human rights of LGBTI persons into the council's mandate for maintaining international peace and security. It's quite a title. This effort is but another step in the American-led push to compel the entire world to adopt our, that is the United States, progressive social agenda. In April of 2022, the Biden administration produced an interagency report on the ways in which all aspects of our government will advance gay rights around the world. These government measures dovetail with a vast network of academic programs, conferences, and legal clinics, and with foundation-funded activist organizations operating at every level. Were someone to tally the direct and indirect expenditure on gay rights and related causes, I would be surprised if they didn't reach $1 trillion per year. So the ambition, he says here, is simple: to strengthen the Rainbow Reich, that's the organization, like a regime, and ensure that it attains global hegemony. From Brussels to Washington, this goal is pursued by every major institution in the West, including, it seems, the Catholic Church in Germany. Often the Rainbow Reich is distinguished by calls for the defense of liberal democracy. Of course, without exception, no country counts as liberal, that's in quotes, that does not wholeheartedly endorse the largest progressive dogmas. In effect, the hegemon in Western initiatives and alliances, the United States leads an ideological crusade to conquer the world. So it's interesting that there's this great push internally in our own country that's also affecting foreign policy. It's being studied through the organ of the United Nations, and it's even through how the government, the United States government, might send support to nations that are not falling in line with some of the principles that are here. So R.R. Reno in this article basically is saying what's going on here, and he compares that to some of the softer, if you would, ways in which perhaps the United States acted in the past. He says he's talking about this turn of events paradoxically reverses the roles played by the United States and the Soviet Union during the Cold War. In 1950, under the leadership of Secretary Dean Acheson, the recently formed National Security Council, the NSC, was commissioned to assess the Soviet threat and outline an American response. The upshot was NSC paper number 68, the document that guided U.S. strategy during the Cold War. Well, what was the nature of that? Well, in his memoir, Present and at the Creation, Acheson summarizes the main thrust of National Security Council number 68. The document characterized the essential difference between Soviet and American ambitions. And this is a quote: The priority given by the Soviet rulers to the Kremlin's design were that rulers to the Kremlin designed world domination contrasted with the American aim and an environment in which the free societies could exist and flourish. Acheson defines this contrast further. Russia adopted this imperial principle. Here it is. No state is friendly which is not subservient. The United States adhered to a capacious approach. No state is unfriendly which, in return for its rights, respects the rights of other states. Put simply, the Soviet Union wished to globalize its communist regime. By contrast, the United States wanted to protect its own way of life, and we were willing to ally ourselves with other countries organized in accord with quite different principles, provided each respected the right of others to live in peace. So basically where the shift has come is that what the communists, which of course are represented by the old Soviet Union and maybe the what was called the Iron Curtain, they said, if we come and take you over, we're going to control you, your thought processes and so forth. We in the United States, when we work with you, we'll give you aid and help in order that you might your processes, the normal way in which you function, your heritage and culture, we're just going to come alongside of that, but we're not going to force you to make any changes. What has shifted is that the American policy now has become like the Soviet policy, in which if you're going to work with us and we're going to work with you, then we're expecting that you will comply, and there's no liberty or freedom to push for anything else. So today's tyranny is that basically Reno says we do not live in a free country. There are many kinds of tyranny. Ours is certainly not like Nazi Germany or communist Russia. Government agents are not knocking down doors in dead of night, although some of that's happening. Dissenters are not being arrested and sent to prison camps. Nor is 21st century America quite what Alex de Tocqueville feared, a society of isolated and timid individuals who welcome the smothering embrace of sovereign power that covers the surface of society with a network of small, complicated, minute, and uniform rules, which the most original minds and most vigorous souls cannot break through to go through the crowds. It's true that we are atomized, that says A-T-O-M, just isolated, and live under a blanket of social control. But the sovereign power is not officialdom, pure and simple. It is something more diffused. But that, he says, also has changed. In fact, he makes reference once again to triad of initials DEI. The process is complete. DEI practices are as much a part of firm culture building. Again, neither the position of DEI officers nor of the refashioned allyship training is mandated by government, or at least not directly. There is no party commissar assigned, but some of the young associates have formed groups and are making demands, and so we're seeing that spirit grow much more. So what has happened is that we have lost our freedom, and that's really talking about the imperial ideology as being lost here in America. And he does provide some help or thinking that might come to, how we can handle it over time. But right now, we are still in the early throes of this. And he says, we're not that aware of all things. We hear, you know, we get a glimmer here and there, but it's not coalescing such that there's a force against the DEI approach and you fall into line or else kind of approach. So, Paul, we've been talking about it here for, 2-3 years since we've been on this podcast, that it's the encroachments are coming and now there are articles being written about it.
Yeah, specifically, though, this is, you know, a foreign policy article, and it falls in line with similar things that I've said on this program. Matter of fact, last week I wrote an article for National File about exporting democracy, and it actually just means forcing LGBTQ rights forcing that on other countries, specifically in Eastern Europe. That is a key part of our foreign policy, and it's something to grip with, something that we have to grip with, because we certainly have a 1980s aversion to the Soviet Union the godless communists. But I mean, this article says that the roles have essentially been reversed in terms of tactics, in terms of a totalitarian ideal, where Russia wanted to remake the world and make a, you know, expand the Soviet Empire, versus what China is doing now. China doesn't want, you know, Iran. When they broker peace, China brokering peace between the Sunnis and Shias, you know, Iran and Saudi Arabia, unheard of. They're not trying to make Iran into a Chinese country and undo their culture and make it a Chinese culture. But we are going into these countries, specifically in Eastern Europe, and we are mandating that they, if they want to join the European Union or they want to join the West, and, you know, they have to adopt gay, quote, marriage, end quote, if they want to be a part of it. Now, this is just, you know, an infringement. And I think this is another reason why you're seeing the, you know, the world dump the dollar. And we still haven't seen the impact that that's going to have on our country. When if those dollars get dumped, then, you know, hyperinflation is certainly a risk, because they, all that money can come back in our country and our currency is now worth less. So anyway, this article is, I'm really glad it was as high up as it is. It really shows the Aquila Report readers are taking notice about what's going on geopolitically. And it's something that we have to come to grips with.
Yeah, it is. And I, as we go through these other articles, I think we'll continue to say that again. Number three, our article is the Lord's Day Minimum Daily Requirement. Beggars should be choosers. This is part three. I think there are other parts have been already published here, and but they're hyperlinked in this article. And this is by Jack Miller, not that Jack Miller. This is a different one. Not the one who founded Sonship. He says in part one and part two, I gave a brief historical tour of my church experience, in which I drew out several lines fundamental, in my most humble opinion, to the process of choosing a church. If you are to live the Christian life, then you are meant to be a Christian in a church. You will choose a church. The thesis of this three-part post is that when it comes to finding a local church, beggars, that is Christians, should be choosers. It is in the local church where, so to speak, the rubber meets the road. So he's affirming the importance of being engaged in the life of a church. The question is, as believers, as we're looking for that place to hang our hat religiously and spiritually, how should we make those choices? So he's giving some considerations, at least that are important to him. So some considerations I previously laid out in choosing a local church were Christ-centered worship, a set liturgy with roots in the Reformation, a liturgy that isn't pared down to mere outline, a church holding to a Reformed confession, a gospel-centered worship around the Lord's Supper, and preaching that presents not the not law as the food for faith, but Christ crucified as found in the gospel. So then he goes into outlining each one of those, like Christ-centered worship, a set liturgy with roots in the Reformation, where, let's say, he says, why? Well, the Reformation brought forth the clearest understanding of the gospel. And it is in the gospel that Christ Jesus is freely offered as food for saving faith, faith by which sinners lay hold of salvation. Simply put, church worship should point to Christ in the gospel as the power of God for salvation for all who believe. So why a set liturgy? As I wrote before, few pastors are up to the task of developing a worship service that approaches what we already have been given. The temptation to innovate is great. And to innovate in an is an invitation to likely veer off course. So where you find a set liturgy where people are going through the regular routine, but at the same time led to see Christ in the center, is what he's advocating. And it says a liturgy that isn't just pared down to a mere outline. I mentioned this due to the tendency in some Reformed churches to have many, if not all, of the above essentials. But unfortunately, in brief or morsels that assume too much of what is left unsaid. So in this article basically is saying, as we look for a church, as if we're especially in the hunt for a church, then there are certain criteria that are very important if we want that to be a part of the rich heritage of the church. And so it's a very helpful article. And I think folks are responding to this because we'll see with an article on the cool and hip church that people are getting tired of the cool and hip, and they're looking for something with a little bit more stability and a little more heft to it.
Yeah, the cool and hip stuff, as we'll find, is a flash in the pan. But you know, the worship of the Lord that is spelled out in Scripture is forever. And anyway, this is a really good article. I really like it, and especially like the breakdown, a liturgy that isn't pared down to a mere outline, a church holding to a Reformed confession, a gospel-centered worship around the Lord's Supper. You know, that's what's so awesome that I have found as somebody who was, you know, raised Baptist, and you know, you take the Lord's Supper once a quarter or something like that. You know, focusing the end of the service on communion, the Lord's Supper, it really makes the entire worship service land on Christ and his sacrifice and his payment for our sins, mm-hmm. and our forgiveness through his blood. So anyway,
I think this article really is helpful. Again, just draw us again to the seriousness of what we should be looking for. And so you look, all three parts are must be read to understand the whole. And so we commend that to you. And we good that the Cool Report readers did see that as number three. Okay, number four by Kendall Lankford, pastor in the greater Boston area. Don't leave well enough alone. Why I am preaching at SatanCon. So you've heard of Comic-Con, the comic book things, and there are other con conventions. And he references, Kendall does, his background, that he always sort of tested the limits of things as a boy growing up in a area that was, you know, out sort of rural kind of area in the Piedmont part of the country. And so he just uses that as just the illustration in the background of this. He says, if you are not familiar, the largest satanic conference in human history will be hosted on April 28th through 30, which just passed. In fact, yesterday was the 30th, so that just over, by the Satanic Temple right in our backyard, that is in the Boston area. In this article, I will provide a few reasons why I'm going to Boston, preaching the gospel on the streets, handing out tracts, and praying like crazy that someone down there will be delivered from the darkness and rescued by the light of the world, the light of the word. As you read the article, I hope it will encourage you. And by that, I mean to give you the courage to find creative ways to get involved in Jesus' great mission where you are. Sometimes you cannot leave well enough alone because, and the first thing he gives, no reasons, God is sovereign. So because God is sovereign, we base our hope in him as we engage the world, individuals, as well as other means along the way. So when I heard that the largest satanic conference in human history was coming to Boston, my first thought was that I was gratitude that I would not be there. I do not go to Salem because he lives not too far from Salem, Mass, where you had the Salem witch trials in October. I do not watch horror movies with occult rituals or pagan symbolism. And I certainly am not inclined to be a stone's throw away from the burgeoning bevy of Baphomet best buddies or in the belly of Beantown. I stay away from such things because, you know, leaving enough alone is right. But as I thought about it, I realized that I was acting in fear. You could invite me to preach in any church in New England, storm any library, or skydive out of any plane, and I would have relished the opportunity. But intentionally traveling to a gathering of secular Satanists had unnerved me. So I was reminded that God is sovereign over all things, which means he has the power, and ability to control all things. Nothing occurs outside of his administration, governance, and will. Because of that, even Satan cannot afflict or us unless he has been given divine permission to do so. Think of Job 1. His absolute sovereignty is the reason demons shudder. This is why they necessarily obey him when he issues forth commands. And this is why also unclean spirits cannot even speak unless King Jesus allows. This tells me that he is entirely in control over all things, especially when the gaggle of goth-garbed Luciferians is gathering in our streets. So whatever reasons I might want to stay away, fear cannot be one of them. The Lord is sovereign and in control. Fear has no place in our decision-making. But he also says, well, they're the ones that are trespassing because the Lord has sent us out into this world and it belongs to him, and Satan is the one who's interfering in things, and he thinks he has the authority, and we have to recognize, as Christians, no, God is the one who has not given up any of his authority to Satan. We must imitate Christ and his disciples. Satan tempted Christ in the wilderness. Jesus did not shrink back or hide like a Girl Scout troop encountering a sleuth of hungry grizzly bears. Instead, he courageously confronted the enemy with God's word and watched that the slithering serpent flee in mortal defeat. He is the one who crushes the serpent's head on the cross and inspired Paul to ascribe the same vocation to the advancing church in Romans 16:20. And he also says, we know that Jesus wins. He is the one who calls people by his grace and even out of that darkness. So why am I going to preach at SatanCon? Con is a really helpful article. At least most of the time we're not confronting Satan that prominently. But anytime we're in the world, we're fighting against the world, the flesh, and the devil. And so Kendall Lankford's article here is stirring, and we should at least give it some look. And it was number 4, so people took some note of it.
Absolutely. And yes, in the conservative media circles that I travel in, there's a viral clip that's circulating around from this convention, this SatanCon, where they're ripping the pages. They began the ceremony, I think, by ripping the pages out of a Bible, destroying a Bible, and everybody clapping and cheering. It's pretty disgusting. But as I saw that clip before I read this article, and when I saw that clip, what I thought was, man, you know, these guys, these people, they don't know what they're doing. They don't know the darkness that they're in, and they need to know. Somebody needs to tell them that God does not approve and that they need to repent and turn to Christ. And it's fitting that somebody else, you know, was way ahead of me on that and decided to go and preach on the streets to people who are openly, actively saying, you know, there's good and evil and we choose evil. So
it is. Well, it shows their natural inclinations are bent in that direction to begin with. So excellent article. Number 5 is Agatha Christie Revisions Are the Writing on the Wall. This is by Bruce Party. It says, last week, the Telegraph, that's in England, reported that Agatha Christie's novels are being sanitized for re-release. HarperCollins, their publisher, is removing references to physique, race, and ethnicity in the new editions of Miss Marple and selected Perrault novels. Christie joins Ronald Dahl and Ian Fleming on the list of dead literary icons whose works have been met similar fates in recent weeks. Shakespeare, Dr. Seuss, Mark Twain have also been curbed in other ways. It seems like small potatoes, but you may be missing the big picture. When publishers defile literature, you know the writing is on the wall. It goes on to say these rewritings are not censorship, at least not in the legal sense. Governments don't need to order it. Publishers are choosing to sanitize the literary icons of their own. Anyone who holds copyright can alter a work as they please, especially when dead authors are not around to object. just as Christie had no obligation to write her books in the first place. No publisher is required to print and sell. So these publishers today have the legal right to a duty to reprint them in their original, have no legal duty to do that on their in their original form. So here he says, why would they want to change them? After all, Christie is the best-selling novelist of all time, which is precisely why her books are ideal for such treatment. Literature, along with other popular arts like music and movies, is called the culture. Along with popular things like music and movies, is called culture for a reason. It expresses narratives that tell societies who they are. In 2023, we are social justice nihilist, driven by cultural self-hate and morally panicked about any representation of historical prejudice. And so the question that parody is that this is the writing on the wall about other things that could be changed. Now, Paul, when you just mentioned the example of what happened at the Satanic Convention up there in Boston, where they were ripping out pages of the Bible, probably just and ripping the pages as well, to show we're going to try and revise. Well, first of all, we hate the Bible, and then we're going to have a revision of what the Bible may say, if anything at all. The same thing is happening here. So if we sanitize the past, we won't know what happened in the past. And that goes back to the second article with what's happening with what the U.S. government is promoting in its foreign exchange, yes, in its foreign policy of control, because you're now raising a group and a period of present history that isn't aware of what really happened in past history. So through the literature, through statues, through music and the like that existed before. So in this article, parody is saying, he ends up by saying, if we are willing to acknowledge it, the road we are traveling is no mystery. As Christie's Hercule Poirot said, the truth, however ugly in itself, is always curious and beautiful to the seekers after it. But you can't make people see. They have come around in their own time. Bradbury wrote in Fahrenheit 451, wondering what happened and why the world blew up around them. And that Fahrenheit 451 talks about a dystopic generation which didn't understand why firemen were called to not to put out fires, but to create the fires in order to throw the books in there. And that was their job, not to put out fires, but to throw books in the fire.
But one of the threads that we could certainly trace is the mention of the word hegemony. And that was mentioned in the previous article about foreign policy, and it's mentioned in this one as well. Conservatives and capitalists, the few who are remaining, better get used to this word, hegemony. Hegemony is what leftists have long accused conservatives of imposing on their societies. The cultural hegemony of capitalism, argued Italian neo-Marxist Antonio Gramsci, among others, features a ruling class that maintains power through social institutions rather than with overt force. In other words, capitalists don't need to enforce capitalism when it's the accepted way of doing things. The strategy to defeat capitalist hegemony, read the Revolutionary Playbook, was not through direct assault, but gradual infiltration of institutions and the ideas upon which they operate. So what's being said here is that is exactly what's going on, essentially, with the LGBT enclave, the Rainbow Reich, as the other article said. That's happening, where, you know, they've taken over every institution, and they really truly have, every mainstream institution. I mean, everywhere you look, You know, there's we're coming up on June in a month from now. So it'll be Gay Pride Month again, right? The whole month. And you're going to see every mainstream institution from Hollywood to the NBA to all of the professional sports to all of music to everything on the news media, all the way down to your local ABC and NBC affiliates, you know, local jurisdictions and, you know, in what otherwise would be red conservative towns where their police cars, their local police cruisers have rainbows on them. I mean, you talk about hegemony. That's exactly what's happened here. And people are just now waking up to it. And well, it's not just now waking up. I mean, as I said earlier, we have the legislatures of all of these states, a lot of these more Christian states, as I will call them, are passing laws essentially pushing back against the madness. And that's all going to eventually come to a head because they're essentially daring the federal government to do something about it. So we'll wait and see. But yeah, this article is certainly along that. I keep wanting to say hegemony, but it's how do you pronounce it again?
That's how it's correct.
Oh, OK. Not hegemony. I keep wanting to say hegemony.
Okay. No, hegemony.
Hegemony.
Yeah. Well, okay, you got it right. Well, the next article, number six, keeps this trend going, and this time it's dealing with boys. And the title, Our Lost Boys, by Brenda M. Hafera, writing in Liberty, Law and Liberty. Multiple books have been released in recent years and in the past few decades. The War Against Boys, The Boy Crisis, Men Without Work, America's Invisible Crisis, Of Boys and Men, Why the Modern Male is Struggling, Why It Matters, and What You Can Do About It, that demonstrate with staggering evidence and statistics that boys are suffering and lost, but we have not yet fully determined how to respond to these troubles, and reasonable voices on the topic can be hard to find. So it's interesting that this is the study, and it's a long article, but it's very well documented with from these writings and other statistics that we're asking the question, what turned around? And there are a number of, first of all, the issues that took that have can be documented as having had happened. The question that where there's some disagreement is exactly what it what the reason for is, and it's probably multiple. It's not just one reason in any case. No problem is just one thing per se. Despite the present of polarizing reactions, we cannot overlook the fact that our boys are floundering and bereft of purpose. Young men commit suicide at six times the rate of young women, and the knowledge economy grows. As the knowledge economy grows, the boys fall behind academically. Even their IQs are dropping. The absence of fathers, technological and economic shifts, and an education system that does not nurture boys are all contributing factors. So notice that at least three things are mentioned there, and then the rest of the article, a couple more will be added to that, that are begging for commensurate solutions. If men and women can work in unique ways, ways that acknowledge our interdependence, to urge our boys to be conscientious and strong, this may help ameliorate the crisis. So each one of these books that are referred to in this article basically gives that sort of bird's eye view, you know, 5,000 foot, 10,000 foot overview of this. We have a problem that needs to be handled. For instance, in one of the books, according to the Boy Crisis, written by political scientist Warren Farrell and counselor John Gray, the primary driver of the boys' crisis is the absence of strong fathers and male role models in the community. Single sex spaces can help offset the missing example of a parent. Almost every school shooter is a dad deprived boy, and such boys are more likely to be addicted to drugs, video games, opioids, and online porn, more likely to be depressed, withdrawn, and to commit suicide. They are even more likely to have their life expectancy shortened. That's from the Boy Crisis. The next one in Men Without Work, American Enterprise Institute political economist Nicholas Eberstadt details how men are prime working of prime broken age are willingly unemployed, spending the great deal of time looking at screens. The quote, the elephant in the room is the rampant addiction online to online pornography, exacerbated by the invention of YouTube and the smartphone, which will require not only policy conversion, but religious renewal to subside. It's interesting that the religious renewal is mentioned as this. Another one, in the war against boys, Christina Hoff Summers, a senior fellow emeritus at the American Enterprise Institute, raised the alarm over 20 years ago about our education system. She wrote, boys today bear the burden of several powerful cultural trends. A therapeutic approach to education that valorizes feelings and denigrates competition and risk. Zero tolerance policies that punish normal antics of young males, and a gender equity movement that views masculinity as predatory. Identity politics has ascended even more since that time, and men, that is since the 20 years ago that she wrote, and men, particularly white heterosexual ones, are the prime scapegoat. Young men have reason to feel deflated and cheated. So without just leaving it, you know, negative, that there are options of things that can happen, because this is a matter, if we go back to just the beginning part, of nature and nurture, so working together, what is already in the heart of man, we know it's a fall, but what can nurture do, and the examples that culture will give, especially fathers in home. So he says, I write all of this with good-natured affection. I grew up with two protective and invitingly adventurous brothers, an unfailingly dutiful father, and six ribbing uncles. Men have wonderful virtues and instincts that need to be nurtured and channeled, just as women do. An identity politics premise inclines us to celebrate only the achievements of our own sex and leave the other to its failures. And being reactive, alienating women and stirring up young men courts the same effect. Instead, we can assume goodwill when encountering differences between men and women while restraining ourselves from making sweeping generalizations. Women can choose good men while fathers stand as living examples. Both can reaffirm men's and women's interdependence. Our boys depend on it. So we're just, you know, really pushed in this article. We can all testify how, you know, this issue about young boys and how they find themselves and what they're being, what effects they're having in culture is, they're just lost, as this article says.
Yeah.
And somehow we in the church need to be alert to this and, you know, develop our own ministry approaches.
I think this sums it up. One of the quotes pulled from the article, men no longer have a clear vision of their function in this world if it is not to be a sacrificial provider or warrior. I think that really sums it up. And the reason that men don't have that, again, back to all of these mainstream institutions being co-opted and essentially, you know, reprogrammed to educate people with this feminist dogma. I mean, it really is. I mean, the rise of feminism and the rise of, you know, everything that entails, and all of a sudden men don't feel like they have a purpose anymore because they've been told that just their very existence is toxic, toxic masculinity. You've heard that phrase. And so we have a nation full of feminists who are women, and you have men who claim to be feminist as well, which is, you know, well, we won't go down that road. But you have all these feminists who are, you know, driving to work right now on roads that men built, to go and work in offices and buildings that men built. Essentially, the entire, you know, our entire way of life is not possible without men. And likewise, it's not possible without women because, you know, we all have mothers, right? But we have somehow lost this. We've lost this, what would you call it, symbiotic relationship where, you know, the woman is the helper to the man And instead, we again have promoted women in our society at all costs, at the expense of everything, in the name of equality, whatever that is. And these are the results. We have a generation of men who are, you know, they don't know what it is to be a man, specifically a biblical man. So.
Okay, well, the next continues this theme. So the Equality Report readers were really choosing some things that out of the 56 articles they could have chosen. Understanding ex-Christian America. So this takes, again, another broader view of what's happening in America that used to be considered Christian and now is considered ex-Christian. Brad Vermeulen, this is a review of Stephen Bullivant's prognosis in Nonverts. Okay, think of converts. These are nonverts. The making of ex-Christian America is neither grim nor naive, but unduly not unduly pessimistic or optimistic, but very realistic. Christianity in America is currently going through a watershed period as society and culture continue to secularize. Among younger adults, for every one person who goes from religiously unaffiliated to affiliating with a religion, there are five people who switch in the opposite direction. So that's one to five. You come into the church, but five are leaving. Toward no religion, having no religious affiliation is increasingly becoming normal and even the expectation among certain enclaves of American life. The United States is more ex-Christian and post-Christian than ever before in its history. How did this situation come about? When and what does it mean for the nation? The key number concerning the frequently referenced rise of the nuns, that's N-O-N-E-S, the nun, they're checking the box that said, what is your religious affiliation? And they check none, is likely familiar to many. Roughly one quarter of American adults, or 59 million people, are nuns. And that is atheistic, agnostic, or nothing in particular when it comes to religion. So Paul, just want to just hang there just for a moment to say, if this statistic has any veracity at all, and it's scary, 59 million people have are checked nuns. When we look around, and if we are still living in a thought as members of a church that we live in a predominantly Christian country, this will shake us up with that kind of statistic, to realize that on the average Sunday when we're worshiping, the probably 25-30% of the population, the total population throughout the country, is in some type of house of worship or some kind of religious event. That means anywhere from 70 to 75% are not, and that becomes regular, of which then you have these 59 million who are checking none, and maybe they've checked out as well. So it's just something for us to realize that the mission field is not just around the world, it's right across the street.
Yeah,
that goes. Yeah, go ahead.
No, you go ahead. Sorry.
I mean, just finish up. The proportion of nuns in the U.S. population hovered between 5 and 9% throughout the 70s and 80s. But right around the year 1990, the percentage of nuns began to climb to its current high point. So that's the point. And he's going to make some other comments about, you know, that we're becoming a nation of nonverts, that we're not converting. We are just turning off. And so the question is, how can we turn it on and give them the encouragement that and the ministry of the gospel that was here? And by the way, just to put this in context, and I think I've said this before and used this illustration, I do it when I do teach church history at the very beginning. You know, if you think about on the day of Pentecost, before the New Testament form of the church began, there were 120 who were followers of Jesus, sort of holding out in an upper room, staying out of sight. And they were told to do that until power from the Holy Spirit came upon them, and then they would be the witnesses of Christ. So if you draw a globe, a big picture, and you ask the question, how many believers of the total number of those that were of the population at that point? And I would usually on a whiteboard just draw a big circle representing the globe, of representing everything in that, you know, we don't know how many, I don't recall how many people were on the populated of the earth at that time, you know, just say 100 million, that you just put a little tiny pinprick of, you know, just a dot in the right in the middle of that mass, that this large globe, and that was it. And yet, over time, little by little, you know, the population, the Christian church began to grow through supernatural acts. Of course, 3,000 became 3,120 at by the end of Peter's sermon. The number of the apostles increased to 5,000 in Jerusalem in chapter 4 of Acts. And then after that, we have no whole numbers given, but it says, and the church continued to increase as we go through the rest of the book of Acts and into history itself. So just as a word of encouragement, there were times when Christianity was the definite minority, and it was in a pagan, secularized culture, very dark spiritually. And the gospel came into that, and somehow the church needs to recapture that, is the way I'm reading this article.
Yeah, you know, and he talks about how the book would have benefited from a more substantial engagement with other Christian thinkers, mentions Catholic post-liberals, also mentions Christian nationalism, which he calls MAGA Christianity, but he portrays, this is the quote here, he portrays the future of Christians in America as one of quietism and exile, and doesn't seriously address the full range of, quote, options, end quote, currently on the table. So I found that an interesting, you know, critique of the book as well. And, you know, to your point about being in the upper room, being quiet, waiting on the Lord, you know, I mean, I've talked a lot about the, you know, I've mentioned in several podcasts that we have the political movements going on in each individual state that are really pushing back against what they're doing to our kids, what they're trying to do to our kids, just what many Christians, as well as cultural Christians, I will call them, it would just consider as downright evil. I mean, and but we do have to be real. The political solution, you know, comes after the change of hearts and minds, and that's only done through the saving work of Jesus. That's only done through the call of God, and essentially what we need is we need more converts, and that's what this article is highlighting. I mean, there's plenty of mission fields out there right around the corner, and we need to be praying and being active as we're led to share the gospel, and to also you know, worship the Lord on Sundays with even more you know,